Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Smart Future Podcast with Dr. Marv Langston. I'm Jim Petrosini, and today we have the honor of featuring Olin Hyde, a long friend and technologist here in San Diego. So, Olin, welcome.
Thank you. I am actually thrilled to be here. I've learned so much from both of you and have really, you know, my career has benefited from all that you both have given me. So thank you so much for inviting me to be on.
So, Olin, how about giving us a little bit of background? I know you recently moved away from the company you started, and then you're starting other new companies or whatever you're doing. Exciting. It's always exciting. So give us a little bit of your background.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I'm now 57. And I got to say, I'm seeking a greater purpose than just going out and starting another company. I've started eight. One was venture-backed. The most recently was venture-backed. And I left it. It was growing rapidly. It was profitable. I really was proud of the team and what we had built. And the board of directors and I just had irreconcilable differences. So I decided to go step away and do something different. And that's been a real journey. And kind of when I first left, I got some great advice from a guy named Tom Higley, who has a something called 10-10-10. He wants to change the world with market-based solutions. And he gave me some great advice. He said, the best thing you can do when you step away is to take some time off. And I did, and really got interested in pursuing my hobby of studying the science of consciousness. I think consciousness is one of those great, vast areas of unknown. And a particular interest is machine consciousness. So my career was spent largely around analytics and AI. And I started doing that before AI was popular and before it was in the news every day. And I was very interested in like, how does AI change the way we as people live our lives? And I see the AI transformation as being a major shift in the same vein as the Industrial Revolution decoupled mechanical power from animals, just as the Agricultural Revolution decoupled feeding ourselves from hunting and gathering. AI is decoupling intelligence from people, and that has a profound impact on us. And really what defines people is our consciousness. And it's something we know so little about. It's really interesting to me. And what happened along this journey of studying consciousness, I got really interested in flow states. And I think we've all experienced flow. Jim, you were a basketball player. Sure, you experienced flow when you're playing ball. And flow states are, again, something we don't fully understand. I get it skiing. So I spent a lot of time skiing. And as I get older, I'm less and less able to do the things physically that give me flow states. And so how do we get to those flow states without the adrenaline rush of throwing ourselves off a cliff? So that's kind of what I've been working on. And I've got a couple clients that have come to me, and I kept on saying, no, I'm not interested in working, but they've had such interesting and vexing problems that I work as a growth consultant to a couple companies. One is in the oil and gas space, private equity backed company. So my client's really the private equity fund out of New York. And then I have another company that's a marketing technology company that I really like the team. I like the founders. I just think they're a really interesting group of people. And I think that one thing that binds all of this together is my interest of, you know, how do we create flow states in business the way we think of flow states in sports or in creative endeavors. You know, great musicians go into flow states all the time. So cool. That's a long intro.
You just said about five things I'd like to rip on.
Yeah.
Well, let's just go back to consciousness for a second, because that's sort of fascinating. I heard recently that it may not be, we humans may not be able to have the consciousness we enjoy without language. Because if you think about it, you really only think in language, right? Now, when you look at our pet friends and other species on the planet, obviously they have a form of consciousness, but I think it probably is language that separates us, because we create these rich languages, and from the rich languages, we can create all of the inventions and images and things that run around in our brains to help us think, basically, to be conscious. So it seems to me like language probably is sort of the foundation of civilization in this, in the sense that we have that ability.
I think you're onto something. I would put a little bit of nuance on it, in that a lot of animals have language. You know, a lot of animals are able to communicate. We have evolved our linguistic ability to think about things in abstraction. And so the history of human intelligence, where computer science kind of amplifies this, is if you think of, let's take computer science and how it's evolved, it's ever increasing levels of abstraction. And that continues on the process of which humans have abstraction. So the thing is, for all we know, we are the only animals that tell stories that we believe in. And these stories are not rooted in any fact that we physically experience. They are conveyed through language. We also know that animals have language too. So language in and of itself is not really the key differentiator. It's this abstract reasoning. And I love the work of Yuval Harari. He wrote the book Sapiens and Homo Deus, which really that was his thesis, is that this idea of abstract thought is what differentiated Homo sapiens from the other hominoids from which we were competing for primacy. And so I think that that's an interesting point, Marv. And language is certainly not something that we've ever lived without and had this kind of conversation, right? So in a way, we don't know what our consciousness would be without language. And without language, we can't ask those that aren't able to experience without language. Yeah. So in a way, the Germans have this word Umwelt, our world. We have this very closed system that reinforces itself, that our worldviews get reinforced by our sensations and how we experience the world. And language is something that all humans experience most.
Yeah, that's a great distinction. I mean, obviously, the animal kingdom does have communication skills and abilities, but you're right, the abstraction of stories is what started us down the path of being able to pass knowledge on from one generation to the next, right? And they moved it down through stories until we came to the printing press and the internet and now on to AI. So that sort of brings us into this whole world of generative large language model AI. Where do you think that's really going to take us?
I find it very interesting that it's getting so much attention. An acquaintance of mine who's a TV producer called me and said, you know, we want to do this TV series about AI, and we're worried that, you know, how do we get the genie back in the bottle? And I laughed and said, you know, the genie's been out of the bottle for 20 years. You've just been aware of it since ChatGPT started taking over the most recent frontier of generative language. So generative AI is here to stay. The first paper that I'm aware of was written in 2017. I became aware of it in early 2018. We started playing with generative AI at my last company. It's a big deal. It's the beginning of a long road towards general artificial intelligence. And I think we're starting to see be unequivocal evidence that we're closer than we thought we were to getting there. And I think it has profound impacts on society, the world order, how we think about work. In the world that you guys come from, the military, I think it's profound. And I'm deeply concerned about how national security is impacted by generative AI. The relieving part is other countries around the world, other governments are not necessarily any smarter than ours. So I think that we've seen abundant evidence of that in the Ukraine war, that, you know, the Russians are not nearly the fearsome enemy we thought they were. But I think the real threat in generative AI isn't necessarily from Russia. It's more likely from an unknown actor that we're not aware of. You know, the amazing thing is what small teams can do. Or it's from China, because China has spent a lot of money. Marv, you've spent a lot of money on AI when you were at DARPA. What did you spend, like $3 billion on AI?
Well, we weren't at the time spending more than probably 50 million a year at the time. But remember, that was the time when they were building the language models, because they were really just at that time starting to form language models, which have become the foundation of all these language activities that are going on. And what we couldn't do back in those days beyond barely start to get it to understand sentence structure and be able to write sentence structure, we certainly couldn't put context into anything, which is now, of course, what's been going on for a while. And clearly, it's understandable to see it how it works in the ChatGTP and the Bard and the other ones that are in play.
It's funny. I remember when we first met, we were talking about ontologies, and you know, my thesis was the brittleness of ontologies will be shattered by what neural nets can do. And you know, that was during the dark winter where, you know, Hinton was about the only person really playing significantly with neural nets. Kind of kept that idea alive. And now it's all we talk about. No one's talking about, you know, curated language models anymore. It's just, you know, feed it a large corpus and don't worry about trying to teach it parts of speech. It will figure it out.
Yeah. What do you think, Jim? Where do you think this is going in the military side?
Yeah. So two parts. The company I'm with now, we're already working with Microsoft to build kind of a proposal generator. And I've used ChatGPT on about 6 proposals to generate, you know, responses. One of the comments early is, you know, how do we, you know, unlearn things, because we don't want to write a proposal on information that might be old and outdated, like kind of like past performance. So that's on kind of the business side. On the technical side, you know, we're building some battle management, you know, and I think the mindset, like in the Navy, is the captain of the ship's not going to push a button anymore. It's going to be an algorithm or a playbook. And based on the scenario, you select a specific playbook. And that's a huge culture shock just for the military, because they're used to, you know, making a command and control decision. And I kind of use space as an example. The rocket doesn't, there is no manual abort. It's an algorithm that aborts based on the sensors and the feedback from all the sensors. So it's definitely, I think, going to be a challenge and a cultural challenge just to get the old way of thinking. Obviously, ChatGPT is a start, right?
What's interesting about this, and I had this conversation this morning with a good friend of mine, is that, you know, in his domain, which he's doing executive coaching and leadership type of stuff, you know, the ChatGPT largely spits out gibberish is the word he used. It's not really spitting out gibberish. It's regurgitating what it has learned. And I think what we're learning from ChatGPT is how precious and rare novel thinking is. And novel thinking, I think there was a German scientist, maybe I forget who it was, Schopenhauer, I think, said, first great ideas are ignored, then they're ridiculed, and then they are first they're ignored, then they're ridiculed, then they're dismissed, and then finally they're accepted. Some 4 stages. I'm not getting exactly the 4 stages. But in the case of the military, it's very hierarchical for good reasons, right? There's good reasons for its hierarchy. But what we're learning about knowledge graphs and how knowledge evolves, and I would argue how collective consciousness evolves, it's network. Truth exists at the bottom of that hierarchy, not at the top. And so culturally, how does the military think about tapping into the collective wisdom of the troops? You know, how does the 60-year-old 4-star general tap into the collective wisdom of 30,000 20-year-olds that report up through the chain of command? Because the 20,000 troops on the ground have ground truth of what's happening in a battle, whereas the 4-star general's back in the Pentagon and he's getting layers of abstraction. Each layer of abstraction has a margin of error added to it. So there's not as much truth in the Pentagon as there is, in the Kandahar village.
Yeah. And you're starting to see that, for example, they now have Starlink in the Persian Gulf. And recently there's a new Navy Task Force 59 where they have, you know, several hundred drones, and they're collecting ISR information, and it's all unclassified. And it's, you know, so it's, I think they commented they collected like 20 million data points in a few months. So you're starting to see that kind of, like you said, the end users getting more data and kind of like open source intelligence.
Right.
So it's definitely changing mindsets, right?
So one of the interesting things about consciousness that I've really been intrigued with for years is an idea that came out of the, I believe it was the Korean War. And the question was, why are Soviet MiGs shooting down our Sabre, our F-86 or 87s. You guys know the military names. But we had a better aircraft, and an inferior Soviet aircraft was shooting us out of the skies. And the answer was cognitive load, is that we were giving the pilots too much information, and they couldn't parse through what was the most important information at the moment. And out of this came this theory of bounded rationality, where the human brain can keep track of about seven things at a time. You know, that our working memory, our RAM, if you will, is seven variables. And what AI doesn't have that, right? It can think of billions of variables, especially these large language models. And we think about networked intelligence, you know, when you've got 20,000 troops occupying Afghanistan, pick a spot, you've got 20,000 times seven, you know, 20,000 to the seventh power of states of consciousness. And how do you resolve that into truth that is actionable at the top? It seems like an ideal situation for artificial intelligence to help sort out what is the correct viewpoint for the commander to take for a particular set of decisions, or do you distribute the decision making down to the individual level?
So you're actually talking about an area that I've been pushing on for several years, and that is, because we do so well with AI with language, it seems to me a grave oversight to not be tapping all of the chat that goes on across the military entities, because I argue that the only big thing we've changed in command and control over the last 20 years is we introduced chat to the battle stations.
These are the SIG reps, the situation representation things.
People talking to each other. The 20,000 troops you're talking about are talking to each other if they got any kind of an electronic device, if they're not just soldiers on the field. So what happens is those people at the top that are giving commander's intent and telling the people at the bottom what we're trying to accomplish, which is largely how we've been pretty successful, they don't really have any knowledge that these 20,000 people at the bottom have got that they're chatting about that could actually be filtered up to the top if we wanted to let an AI take a look at it and see how it might filter it up to the top. Instead, we keep trying to have AI at the command and control level generate game plays or ideas for movements or ideas about what you could do to carry the battle to the next level, courses of action they call them. But we really don't take advantage, to your point, of what the troops know at the bottom that the top doesn't know. That could be a game changer. So it'll be interesting to see how that might evolve.
That's fascinating, because that, you know, it's the another, what I'm interpreting you're saying is we're so obsessed with top down command and control that bottom up intelligence gathering is still something we haven't figured out.
We used to say in the open source world, bottom up, right? You know, the open source community kind of grows and decisions are made bottom up, right? But the DoD buys top down, and it's a huge culture change, right? And that's kind of the rub, even though honestly, like, I was on Carl Vincent 10 years ago and my buddy was battle group commander, and I said, command control was chat. They had like seven chat windows and they were just chatting with different commands, and they were hardly using the legacy command and control systems.
It's not uncommon, Olin, to see a person on an operational screen, like in CIC, with seven or eight chat windows open. And they're doing their job and chatting to seven or eight different people at the same time while they're doing their job. But nobody's paying attention to what's going across the chats. It's just their own conversations.
Well, one of the things I've been looking at, I don't know if you guys have read Strength to Strength, Arthur Brooks' book he wrote a couple of years ago. And the idea is that, you know, as we're young, we have fluid intelligence, and that's, you know, why mathematicians reach their peak before age 30. And as we age, that ability to fluid intelligence of being able to make sense of partial information and find patterns is superseded with what's called crystallized intelligence, which is, you know, a fancy word for wisdom. That you've seen patterns before, you know how it's going to play out. And there's a really good reason generals are 60, is they have crystallized intelligence. And presumably they're better at making those type of decisions because they can think in second, third, fourth, fifth order consequences, just like the chessboard does. And why, you know, 18-year-old grunts are not generals is because they have more impetuous decision-making and they're not as mature, don't have the experience and breadth to understand all the consequences. So the top down makes a lot of sense for a military in some context for, you know, commander's intent, but the bottom up is again, valuable as well for the fluid intelligence it offers. I really think that would be an interesting area for the government to spend a little bit of research money on and maybe scenario out how it's a communication, but not top down is one direction or bottom up is what we're talking about, Jim, is another, is unidirectional. It's a conversation. And how do you have a conversation one to thousands or one to dozens as it goes through the chain of command to create a reality that's more controllable and explainable? Because that's ultimately what commanders have to do is make decisions that anticipate the future and control it in a way that randomness won't.
Yeah, I think it's your,
I really like to go ahead, Jim.
Oh, Olin's comment earlier about more of a distributed intelligence, you know, and more of a community decision making, and more of like a graph database, right?
Yeah,
I wanted to move us up beyond the military, but before we leave, this one thought you reminded me, Olin, in George Friedman's book, The Storm Before the Calm, yeah, where he argues that we're in this decade of chaos that hopefully is going to come out on the other side of like the first turning again, where we have the United States remaining on top to help a better world and a better society. But he points out in there that every one of these major turnovers that have occurred in the world and the United States before have also been accompanied by a major change in the way we ran the government, the way the government functioned and operated.
Right.
And what you reminded me of is his point was that he believes our federal government or state governments could operate better if they would adopt commander's intent as opposed to rigid policy. And right, not make all the rigid policy the way we operate these functions that are government functions, but rather tell people what the intent is and let the people at the bottom make decisions to support commander's intent. So I guess maybe we can watch and see if that happens at the end of this decade.
Yeah, I from your lips to God's ears, make it so. I think that a lot of government is explained by the fact that it is ideologically driven or driven by party agendas as opposed to truth. I mean, imagine how different government would look as if we measured the social return on investment in a given policy. You know, if we measured social return on investment, we would probably be spending a lot less money in much different ways than we do now, because it seems like so much of government is driven by opinion as opposed to fact.
Yeah. So let me just take it up to the next question. So you probably haven't seen Jeff Booth's book, The Price of Tomorrow, but he talks about the fact that technology is all deflationary. So all technology, everything that we do to technology is making us more productive, which means we could do more for less energy, less time, less hours. Or in the case of a lot of the devices we now enjoy, we don't pay a dime for photographs anymore. We pay hardly anything for music. Right. And because technology always drives the price to the marginal cost of production. Sure. But he also would argue that because we have set our government up and our world up on a assumed need to have inflationary money, 2 or 3% per year is what we call the ideal. The right. Inflationary government is fighting the deflationary technology production. And so he says that contrast and that confluence is what's going to come to a head over time, because we've already got our fiat money system so over the skis that we could never recover from 130 or 40% debt to GDP ratio. But I want to bring it back to the AI and the evolution of technology that is going to produce workers that can do a lot of the work that we already do as humans. And some argue that maybe we're going to have to try and figure out what humans are going to do in the future, because they won't need to do very much, because the robots and the AI will be able to do all those things for them. So I just want to get you guys' thoughts on some of those ideas.
I mean, I'll add one thing in some of the discussions about using ChatGPT. I think I read Microsoft expects to make $40 billion, but some of the discussions is nobody knows how much it really costs to set up a, you know, I'm going to use ChatGPT to do proposals. Is that going to cost me $1 million a year? And is, you know, and you know, and I know that right now Microsoft's charging, like they give you a bunch of like tokens, and every time you do a ChatGPT request, it's like two tokens, you know, and cost that like $2. But if you start to add that up across a large company, so I think you know, the valuation of the cost of this is going to be an interesting how it all, but I agree with you, it's going to probably get
cheaper. Think it's true in OpenAI right now, they're spending way more than they're receiving on allowing ChatGPT to be out there. Even if you sign up for the $20 a month for they're spending more than that to give you the answers you get.
Yeah,
right.
So the freemium model, right, at play, like get people hooked, right?
Well, it's captured the flag. They got 100 million users in their first, what, 3-4 months of release.
Sure.
So you would, I work with private equity guys that think in free cash flow to the firm, you know, like the free cash flow is everything. And so they're used to, you know, capital expenditure type of businesses. CapEx is what they think about. In technology, we think of OpEx. Jim, you know this better than anybody. You pay for growth. Because the one thing that is has intrinsic value is active users. And 100 million active users is worth losing a lot of money for, because when you finally figure it out, it looks like Google. Google lost a ton of money owning the market, getting the market, but boy, they sure make a lot of money now. And they turned all of that OpEx expenditure on growth into, you know, capturing a very large percentage of digital advertising goes through Google.
I remember your lead crunch when you were measuring on your phone how many new clients you were getting every day. It was eye-opening.
We rebranded the company. It's now called Rev, getrev.ai. And yeah, it was stunning. But when we first went to market, we got something like 15,000 signups in the first month. And we didn't know how to price it. We learned on the job, as most startups do. And our price per unit went from $2 per unit, we were losing our shirts on, to an average of about $65, $70 per unit in the course of about a year. And guess what? We were making a lot of money at $65 per unit.
Hey, let me propose something for you guys. We're really coming up on 30 minutes. Seems like we're having a good discussion, and there's a lot left we could bring into this table. So if you're okay with it, let's just plan on a part two, and we can break up the...
Well, I'm thrilled. I'll have my thoughts more organized next time.
All right. Well, let's keep going. So where do you think these the employment goes as we evolve this stuff forward?
Well, I think that to bring it back to the question of how AI impacts it, first we have to define what is intelligence. And I would argue that our intelligence is the biological response for surviving longer. You know, we have intelligence so that we get more food, have better shelter, have better spouses. And when we think of the economy, that's just collective intelligence of like, how do we as a society or group or whatever cohort you want to look at it, from the village to the nation, how do we survive and thrive better than we could on our own? And then, of course, you have competition, both at the individual level and the collective level. And that's where, you know, societies clash. We have wars because we have different values. We have different ways of trying to gain supremacy. And I think that when you ask the question, where does AI take us in the economy? Well, the economy is that manifestation of trying to get something better. And if all of a sudden you can separate intelligence from people, then the question is, to what end does that intelligence work? And I think that is an area of great concerns, because it could be used for very bad things, also be used for very good things. And there's probably a distribution of outcomes. On one end, we've got the Terminator, annihilate humans. On the other end, some type of utopia. The likely scenario is somewhere in the middle. And I think that what we're going to see is increasing bifurcation between, say, the creative classes, the things that AI can't do. And that creative class would also probably involve the emotional intelligence classes. Like, you're not going to go to an AI for psychological counseling, or you don't want your nurse to be AI, because a lot of that's just making you feel good, because the human touch, you can't do that with a machine, at least yet. So I think that when we look at like where AI is going to replace people, it's going to have, you know, the first place I'd start is lawyers. Boy, no one's going to cry if they lose their job. And AI has already profoundly impacted the law firm. You no longer hire, you know, when I was coming out of school, you'd hire hordes of junior lawyers to basically do discovery. Well, now most discovery is done electronically, and you've eliminated, you know, tens of thousands of jobs in law from that result. You know, taxi drivers, if Uber hasn't taken them out, self-driving cars will. I think those type of jobs disappear pretty quickly. The ones that don't disappear are the novelists, the actors, the people that are either highly emotional in their value or highly creative in their value. And I'm not sure what that economy looks like. And I think it really gets to what end are we building this economy? What is our objective? Is it the creation of wealth, which is what capitalism is about? Or is it sustainability? I think these are really big questions. And the answers are probably, what is the next socioeconomic paradigm? You know, just as capitalism replaced feudalism, what's beyond capitalism? I'm not smart enough to know that.
Yeah, Marv, I would say, like in the military world, right, the $800 billion defense budget probably will lean towards unmanned technologies, right? Because, you know, and there's a lot of discussion, is the future war all unmanned, right? And is it going to be
video? I got a question. Why do we have pilots?
Yeah.
I don't know why, seriously, like, why do we pay money to build piloted aircraft when, you know, a machine can pull more G's and presumably act way faster than a human? Why do we have an Air Force with pilots?
Well, you even have to ask yourself, why do you have airplanes, right? The reason we have airplanes is because you could load bombs, go drop them, come back, get more bombs, right? You could reuse the vehicle to do that same function again, but to do that, we needed pilots, right? But because we've gotten these vehicles so completely out of the scope of rationality for the cost of an F-35, and when you lose an F-35, now you've lost a major component of your military capability because it costs so much. But if you were to just deliver every one of your ordnance items, whatever they are, with a UAV, and let it fly over, whether it's a drone, whether it's a swarm or not, you could probably come up with the same cost equation structure that we run through the thing we do today. But we've got to remember, a lot of what we do today is rooted in the past. It's that crystallized knowledge, I guess. And so we keep thinking aircraft carriers and manned aircraft are the need for the future, when in fact, maybe that isn't the need for the future. But we in the military usually don't come up with the right next solution until we lose in the war that took the old solution out. So that's going to be interesting. But here's something we haven't
talked really
about.
That's really interesting.
One of the things that's different about the emerging AI technology than previous technology is almost all previous technology has harmed the working class folks' jobs. They have put people out of business, right? More or less, or lower the need for those kind of people. AI is actually the first thing that's coming along threatening the middle and upper class people that are doing the white collar jobs versus the blue collar jobs. Now, when you get into the robots, you can say, well, that goes back and takes out the blue collar jobs, because we'll take out all of the workers that have to do physical work with the robots. Most likely that's what Elon's trying to do for his factories, right? As his right. First use case. And all of these are going to be competing with what we do with ourselves, but it's going to be interesting to see what
the technology goes. I would argue slightly differently. I think that technologies, when they first appear, have a deleterious effect on the lower classes, you know, but as time evolves, people find other, you know, it creates new jobs in different areas. And the life that I live is far greater, far more abundant than my ancestors as a result of technology. And so I think the question of the middle class, upper class, you know, the distribution of wealth across society is the question we should be talking about for AI, because it does affect all classes, unlike other technologies. And unlike other technologies, it replaces human intelligence. So therefore, humans are not going to evolve up into the next level job. You know, they're not going to find a higher use of their skills because a machine will take that over. So it's basically created, what are humans are pets now? We're pets of the AI. What does that look like? It can lead to some pretty absurd situations. But the reality is what Jim, I think you said, is like, look, you know, decisions are made from the top down. We got crystallized intelligence driving these decisions. That's true throughout society. It's not just the military. And there also is resistance to change. And the reason we have pilots is that pilots are highly resistant to the idea that they can be replaced with a machine. And that's true for lawyers, too. You know, I had a dinner the other day with a lawyer that told me why he could never be replaced. And I'm like, really? Here's an app that I'm using that does exactly what you do, but it was $1,200 as opposed to, you know, $50,000 for what you do.
We just we just lost our ad revenue from the law firm that we were going to.
Their money's dirty anyway.
Yeah. No, I think this will generate a lot of future discussion, right? And we haven't said the word Bitcoin yet, but there's a major in the Space Force that Bitcoin is a weapon system, and it's a totally cool idea.
That is a real, so Bitcoin solving a problem that I don't think anyone really cares about enough yet to adopt a solution, right? And so I think that we're really, the economics part of this conversation, I'm not particularly qualified to talk through all of the economic implications. But if we think about the power of what the internet, you remember when the internet came out, I was a junior analyst at a strategy consulting firm, and we were talking about TCP,
which TCP/IP.
Thank you. The protocol underneath it, and with ISDN, and we were talking about all of these acronyms, which were really protocols. No one could really envision Amazon or Apple TV or Spotify. That was not what people were thinking about. The question was, in 2000, will the internet be trustworthy enough for someone to actually build a real business on it? That was only 20 years ago. The same questions are being asked about Bitcoin now. And no one, by the way, has built a real business on Bitcoin. You can't eat a Bitcoin. I can eat what comes out of the internet, do it every day when I get my Sunbasket delivery.
Yeah.
Well, what Bitcoin really is about, if you go into it, is it's about money over IP. So when we created voice over IP, music over IP, photos over IP, all the things that we enjoy today, because of the ability of this independent, standardized, non-human controlled internet that's spread all over the world. So right now, interestingly enough, we can reach out and talk to anybody on the planet if they've got an IP device on their somewhere in their hands, like a telephone, and we don't have to cross any government permissions to do that. If we wanted to pass money to those people, we got to go through government systems and financial systems and transactions and clearing processes that take days, if not months. So what's happening is we are creating the new internet of money on the internet, money over IP, that is just beginning to grow. It's about the same place the internet was in when Jim showed me what WWW was back in 1995 or so. And now we have this thing that governments can't control that does allow me to send money from here to South Africa if I want to, with a minimal amount of costs and a minimal amount of time, and nobody can stop it. Nobody can tell me I can't do that. That transforms the world in a network way, in a radical network way.
But we can also do it with sovereign currencies, with Venmo and PayPal and Apple Pay and so forth.
You can,
but what you're describing, I think the real big issue or the big benefit of Bitcoin is the blockchain itself, the ability that you do no longer have to trust each other. I kind of have to trust you when I use Venmo, right? I got to trust that you're going to deliver the service that I'm paying for.
Everything we do financially today causes us to have a counterparty risk to something, right? To the bank, to the government, to something. So you always got counterparty risk until you go to Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't have counterparty risk.
Yeah, it's true. Decentralized.
It's just got an energy network that's validating and controlling your processes so you can do anything you want to on it that nobody can stop. That will continue to catch on as people start to figure that out. It just takes a long time to understand it and figure it out.
The energy costs are interesting as like a restriction, as a limiting factor. You know, does the energy cost, does it hinder its adoption for whatever reason? Either we can't produce enough energy, energy gets too expensive. You know, typically these technologies, energy requirements decrease over time exponentially, but with Bitcoin, it's proof of work. So how do you decrease the energy costs of proof of work? You're really relying upon Moore's law to do that, right?
So we should spend a whole session talking about energy because it's one of my favorite subjects. One of my most favorite things this week was Microsoft just let a contract with this fusion company called something like that. I'll dig it out for you. But what these guys did is they said, we're going to provide you 50 megawatts of fusion power, fusion energy by 2028. And if we don't, we'll pay you default payments. So wow. They're betting their company that they're going to produce fusion energy by 2028. And the other thing, when you look at it, that's really fascinating is they're not going to produce fusion heat to turn it into steam, to turn it into electricity. They're producing electricity directly from the plasma, the fusion plasma.
Wow.
This is the most fascinating thing I've seen to date.
So
if we're this close to fusion, energy is not a problem. We're going to have all the energy we want.
And we said the same thing when we got
spoken from a Navy nuke.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't you guys say the same thing when we got nuclear power?
We could have all we want with fission. The problem with fission is it's dirty. We don't want dirty energy. Fusion energy is clean energy.
Yeah.
I would love to have a conversation about energy because I am doing a lot of work with an oil and gas.
And that's why I brought it up.
Production technology company. And I've learned a lot. I was born for it because I'm dyslexic. My name is actually Oilin.
and to wrap this up, Olin, would you get on an airplane with no pilot on it?
I get in my car, drive 80 miles an hour with no driver. I've got a self-driving Tesla.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I think there's no pilot really. Most of the flight, it's being driven by an autopilot anyway. So the question is the pilot really adding that much value at the beginning and at the end? And maybe it is. You know, it's funny, air travel is so safe. It's just mind-blowing how good the pilots are, right?
Yeah.
They've done a really good job of training great pilots that keep us safe, and I'm grateful for that. I don't know if we are ready for that big leap, Jim. I think that's an emotional decision more than a rational decision.
And I think that's where AI in general, right? This is a cultural, emotional change. How as a society, how quick can we really change?
Right. But with the pilots in the military, I would think they'd be happy to get out of the aircraft so that they don't get shot down. I mean, I would ask some of the Russian pilots how it feels.
So to the rate of change, Jim, let me just add my firm conviction, I guess. We changed the world since 1994 with the internet from then to what we have now. And along the way, we created use cases that we didn't even know we could wanted to create, like Wikipedia, right? Who would have ever thought that somebody come up with replacing the Encyclopedia Britannica with people all writing in and updating what it is, and you can look up anything on the planet in Wikipedia, right? And it's free or largely free. So we're going to have new use cases that'll occur out of money over IP, whether it becomes Bitcoin or some other standard, that is going to rapidly figure out that this is the right thing to do. And the most exciting thing to me about it is if we can separate money and state the same way we separated church and state, we can have governments that are much more effective and productive at focusing on what people need and need to have than governments that keep getting out of control and deciding they're going to inflate our money and go to war and do whatever else they want to do, right? So I think Bitcoin all by itself right now is creating the parallel rails so that the governments all have to say, geez, I guess I better watch that because people could go a different direction if they wanted to. I can no longer tell them you can only spend my Argentina money or my dollar money or my British pound money, right? They yep. can't control that anymore, much, much better than
you could just in blew the past. My mind, Marv. My mind's blown on the idea of like just like separating intelligence from people, separating the government from money is a really cool idea.
It's fascinating. It's the most interesting idea going on right now.
Who's talking about it? Is that something that's
Bitcoin
in the public
people.
Sphere?
Bitcoin people. The Bitcoin yeah. people. And yeah. the biggest Bitcoin conferences that they have every year is going on in Miami right now, today and tomorrow. If you look up on YouTube for the Bitcoin conference and look at some of the speakers and some of the talks, you'll find out that they're going to bring that topic up, money over IP.
This is a bestseller on Amazon. It's from the major from the U.S. Space Force that's doing the, you know, he's saying we got to get away from kinetic energy and killing everybody. So maybe Bitcoin can be that, you know, it comes out to power. It's a power distribution, right? Who has the most electrical power is going to deter any kind of kinetic power.
No, I'm glad you brought that back up again, Jim. I meant to mention it. So what yeah. the major's saying in soft power is every time we've gone into a different space, airspace, undersea space, land space, we build up military capability in those spaces, space, we build up military capability in those spaces. Now we have cyberspace. Nobody ever thought about what to do about military capability in cyberspace, short of cyber war and the stuff we do on the, you know, on the hacking side of it. But what he's saying is you need to, in order to have national security, you've got to have a capability that's a deterrent in cyberspace just as much as you do in all the other spaces. And because of blockchain technology and Bitcoin, we could, if the United States adopts it and moves into it right, have a major control part of the cyberspace world by taking advantage of that. The other part, here's another thing that we can add to another discussion. The idea we were talking about robots, about knowing whether or not if you see a video, whether it's Olin talking or Olin's fake video talking, right? You don't know right now. But right. one of the things they're talking about doing with blockchain and or Bitcoin, because you could tie it into Bitcoin if you wanted to, is making everything that is you reference to your private key on blockchain. So if your private key on blockchain doesn't say that's a video coming from Olin, then it isn't a video coming from Olin. Right. So we could actually start to tie down the cybersecurity processes of our planet by pulling everything up into this non-controlled new piece of the internet, the Bitcoin piece of the internet, and tie everything into blockchain. Right now, there are people that are birthing their babies and attaching their baby's name to the 10-minute block of blockchain, saying that block number is associated with their child's birth.
Yeah, it's the new not the new Nostra social community, which you get a public key and a private key, and I think the app on the iPhone is called Damus, you know, Nostradamus. But Nostra is kind of it's decentralized. There's no central server like Facebook or
nobody controls it.
WhatsApp. It's not controlled. It's decentralized. Yep. So yeah, definitely cool. A topic.
I was not aware of that. I need to go get that app now.
Yeah, Damus.
All right. I'll send you some stuff on the fusion business, because it's fascinating what this company has bet. And there's some really cool videos that you can watch for a few minutes about how they're producing the nuclear fusion. And they're in the process right now of building their seventh iteration of the technology. And that's what they're putting online with Microsoft and betting the farm on.
That's amazing. That's very cool.
Because we always said fusion is a decade away, and it's always a decade away. And I woke up yesterday and they said, no, it may not be. It could be 2028, 5 years away.
Well, it's a decade away until it's not. And when it's not, it usually happens a lot faster than we think it is.
Well, that's sort of what happened to AI, isn't it? It's always a decade away until all of a sudden it wasn't.
Right. Yeah. Well, I always learn so much from both of you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Phenomenal.
All right. Well, we've used up a whole hour, so I'll pull these videos together and see if we can do something with this. And I'll go ahead and turn the video off right now. Let's see. Stop.